is now in session. Is there anyone here that is for House Bill 3912? 3912? Okay, we are not going to do a work session on that, I mean a vote session on it today, but if you have some comments, I'll open that up and you can bring them forward. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3912.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the Subcommittee. Rich Vile, and I am with the Bar and the Community Associations Institute groups that are working on this legislation. You may recall that when we were here last week, one of the owners in a homeowner association in Bend raised concerns about some of this legislation. In the O2 amendments that you have now in front of you, we have addressed several of her concerns, and we have not addressed two. And I want to
could I just stop you for a second? That's the reason we're not going into the work session, is we don't have the O2 amendments yet.
We don't have copies, so we can't refer to them. So
okay. Well, let me then just briefly tell you what you will see in them.
Okay.
In the O2 amendments, we have addressed Ms. Harriet Heise's concerns about having secret ballots. We have included a provision that upon vote of 10% of the owners in a project, a secret ballot would be required for votes of the owners themselves. She also indicated a concern about using alternative dispute resolution provisions. We have included a provision that would require associations and or members of the association before instituting litigation to take advantage of any county sponsored alternative dispute resolution such as mediation. ORS Chapter 36 has a provision that sets up mediation processes in counties. We have required that anybody who wants to sue each other has to go take advantage of that if it's available in the county before instituting the litigation.
You mean through the circuit court, that mediation program?
Well, ORS Chapter 36 sets up a dispute resolution board, and there's some funds that are allocated, and counties apparently can take advantage of that if they desire. It's not exactly the same, as I understand it, Representative Shetterly, as the circuit court mediation process. It's a separate board. But it is the one that seems to be most uniform across the state in terms of the likelihood that counties have it. The one we did not address, which I think is important for the committee to know about, is the requirement that liens for attorney's fees, fines, those sorts of things cannot be foreclosed upon. We discussed that at length among all of the groups that we worked with, and it was uniformly believed that unless the association had the ability to foreclose on the lien, regardless of the purpose for which the charges were initially established, that it would essentially take all of the enforcement opportunity out of the fine process, for example. It should be noted, however, of course, that before any lien can be foreclosed, the person against whom the lien is asserted will have the opportunity to go through a judicial process, so there should be no prejudice to an owner. Those essentially are the changes that you'll see in those O2 amendments, and we believe with them we have a bill that should be something we can pass on.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Mr. Vile? Thank you very much.
And for the benefit of the members, I spoke to Legislative Council. Actually, I got a message from Legislative Council on Friday that we would be getting those amendments sometime today. As soon as I get them, because they are going to be involved, I'll get them passed on to the members of the committee, and then I'd like to put this back on Wednesday morning and Wednesday afternoon so we can get it moving.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3912. Thank you. hearing on Senate Bill 130. Council, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 130 gives a tax court judge discretion to award reasonable attorney fees and costs to a prevailing taxpayer payable by the Department of Revenue in property tax appeals.
Okay, Larry Tappanen, Dave Canary, and Betsy Earls.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls from Associated Oregon Industries, appearing before you in support of Senate Bill 130. And with me today, I have Dave Canary and Larry Tappanen, AOI members, who will explain the details of Senate Bill 130 to you and how we got to this point. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is David Canary. I'm a private attorney with the firm of Garvey, Schubert, and Bear. I represent taxpayers. I've been a former Assistant Attorney General representing the Department of Revenue. Prior to going into private practice. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 130. As the chair and the committee may know, we have now two levels of appeals to the tax court. One is a less formal level, which is the magistrate's division, where a taxpayer, county, or the Department of Revenue may appear unrepresented by an attorney. And then either party may appeal to the regular division of the tax court. However, when you go to the regular division of the tax court, just like going to a circuit court, you must be represented by legal counsel. It's very daunting for a taxpayer, particularly smaller taxpayers, to appear in the magistrate's division, and then if they win or even if they lose, to go up to the regular division of the tax court to hire an attorney. We feel this bill will level the playing field a little bit in view of the fact that the county assessor and the Department of Revenue are represented by the Attorney General's office, will allow the tax court discretion that if the case is meritorious on behalf of the taxpayer and the taxpayer prevails, that the state would pay the taxpayer's attorney's fees if the taxpayer prevails. So we believe this will level the playing field. It will make the magistrate's division probably a bit more significant for the parties to meet, try and settle the differences without incurring legal fees and going up to the tax court. Thank you.
Chair Walker, committee members, my name is Larry Tappanen. I'm owner of an appraisal company, Tappanen Group. I've been representing taxpayers and counties for nearly 40 years in out of court and judicial forums. I'm in support of this bill, in that it, as Mr. Canary did say, it levels the playing field. It makes the magistrate court that was established in 1997 a more effective forum for all participants to work within. The tax court, as it currently is an expensive forum to wage a dispute in. This would lower the cost to taxpayers who have limited resources and feel they have a supportable claim. Over the years, there has been more of a litigative nature. Lately, it has been better. This bill was set up in such a way that it followed an existing law. It has been a law that allowed for the same type of treatment for personal income tax. In that arena, we have very few disputes that are litigated. So it appears when we set up the bill that this would be a place to expand the scope of the personal property to include property tax. And so this is not a new concept. This is just an expansion of a law that is in place and works.
Anything else you wish to add, Ms. Mills?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to take any questions at this panel.
Representative Ringo.
Thank you. Do you have any estimate as to what the Department of Revenue would have to pay for attorney fees each year?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, we did talk a little bit about this on the Senate side, and I believe the fiscal impact statement is about $250,000. The bill did not go to Ways and Means because, and the person who wrote the fiscal can come up here and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the way this works is she estimated that based on 5 cases, which may or may not be appealed up from the magistrate's division, and then which the judge may or may not award attorney fees.
I'm sorry, based on 5 cases?
I believe so. But
so you're anticipating there would be 5 cases where attorney fees would be awarded of $50,000 each?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, we're not anticipating anything at all. That was what the assumption was that the person that wrote the fiscal made.
Madam Chair?
Representative Ringo.
Well, I'd just like to understand that fiscal a little more. Maybe you're not anticipating it, but somebody else is, that there would be 5 cases under which attorney fees would be awarded.
That's correct.
In each case, the attorney fee award would be $50,000.
That's my understanding. That's my understanding from talking to the person who wrote the fiscal, Madam Chair.
We don't have the fiscal. That's what we're looking for.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
This bill would make attorney fees discretionary. It doesn't say shall. It says may. But was there any discussion at the Senate side about what criteria will be used in the exercise of that discretion?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, I don't remember. Larry, do you remember?
Is the question, what did we anticipate?
Well, this says a judge may award attorney fees, and I'm just wondering what is going to inform the judge's discretion.
Representative Ringo, I do not have the judge's mind as to what he thinks is open for discussion. We have a task force judge who has never ruled in that manner.
Representative Shetterly.
We have in Chapter 20 a statute that outlines the factors that the court would consider whenever fees are authorized by statute and in which the court has discretion to decide.
Okay.
And that gets... there's a fairly long laundry list of things for a court to consider, so that would automatically apply to a case like this.
Those are whether a particularly abusive situation, for example.
For the record, Madam Chair.
Please, Representative Shetterly.
Conduct of the parties, including any conduct that was reckless, willful, malicious, or in bad faith. Objective reasonableness of the party of the claims and defenses, the extent to which an award of attorney fees in the case would deter others from asserting good faith claims or defenses, the extent to which an award of an attorney fee in the case would deter others from asserting meritless claims and defenses, objective reasonableness of the parties, diligence of their attorneys during the proceedings. That gives you a flavor of the kind of considerations.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly.
Madam Chair, just one more.
Representative Ringo.
Is this bill based on the feeling that the Department of Revenue is occasionally unreasonable in dealing with a taxpayer on tax issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, I think in the past there has been that feeling. I think with the new administration and with the people that are in place now in that administration, that feeling has lessened considerably. But I think there's still the opportunity for abuse in some situations, and consequently I think this bill, as Mr. Tappan has testified, it has expanded a very successful bill that's in place now for personal income taxpayers to apply to property taxpayers. So it's really not a radical change, it's just expanding the scope that has been successful.
Thank you.
Well, we did get the fiscal, and I, too, am somewhat surprised that 5 cases would be $250,000. Yeah, they can be complicated. I know that. Okay. Everyone has their copy. I would like to also enter into the record that we have received comments from the Taxpayers Association of Oregon and D. D.R. Johnson Lumber Company as well that will be entered into the record. You may have just sent it to me as chair of the committee. I didn't realize you didn't have him.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I guess I'd like to note for the record, I mean, this fiscal is part of the record, but this assumes that attorney fees will only be awarded, one, in matters that involve substantial precedence, two, where the case was deemed entirely without merit by the court, and three, those in which the financial impact on the taxpayer was substantial.
Mm-hmm. I see those the three assumptions
right.
that they made here.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Is there anybody lined up to testify against this?
No, there's no one. I have one more person to testify for, but no one to testify against it.
Madam Chair.
All right.
It just occurs to me when we get done with the testimony, if you want to move this into work session, to send it. Confirm whether there is or is not. An
right. We can do that.
And if I could just clarify, does everyone have copies of these? Did they get faxed?
Yes.
Okay, so it's just me.
Okay, while we're waiting for that, any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jim Craven.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. I think at this point I'm just in the position of giving the bill an attaboy. We've worked with the proponents of this bill, and I think all the major points have been made here, that this is a parallel scheme to an existing set of statutes regarding appeals on income tax. This just does a parallel. It's actually in the same section of the ORS. It sets up a parallel possibility of at the court's discretion of fees and costs being awarded. I do think it will, I think this body made a substantial move forward in 1997 by establishing the Magistrates Division, and I think things have gotten on a much better track since then from what I've heard from my clients. And I just want to echo the responsiveness of the Department of Revenue, at least to our industry's concern over the last few years. We meet once a year in an all-day meeting with members of the high-tech industry and members of the Department of Revenue and to go over a host of issues, and I've just seen an incredible responsiveness to the concerns that have been raised by our industry. So I don't think this should be portrayed as that we're trying to throw a wrench into a very contentious situation. I think things are actually getting better and better all the time, and I thank the department for that and for their being responsive to our concerns. So I think this is a fairly small bill that I think will improve the process, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Craven? Thank you very much. Kevin Mannix, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney appearing here on my own behalf. I've already heard the testimony in favor of the bill. I'm delighted to be here today just to say that I'd encourage your support for this. I became involved in the tax court system when I sponsored the Magistrates Division legislation in 1997. I was pleased to be asked to assist with this legislation and to do my small part in what I think is a continuing effort to reform the tax system. And I know Representative Shetterly is taking a look at the mechanism of collection in terms of the where we go and what we do, and that's a very big part of the picture. This bill deals with part of the process. Once the policy decisions have been made by the legislature, how taxpayers are treated, and this is another small improvement in the system as part of a number of efforts over time to improve our tax system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Mannix, thank you very much. Okay. I think what we'll do on this one is go ahead and pass it to the full committee rather than a, pardon?
You have the votes?
I think I do. I haven't seen anybody express any doubts here. And we can... make the decision regarding our budget between now and that time.
Madam Chair.
Okay, yes.
I mean, just for purposes of discussion, I do have doubts, but I think it would be fruitful to go ahead and let the full committee look at this.
Okay, any other comments? Okay, I'm going to close the hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 130. Any further discussion? None?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 130 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 130 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. And would you please call the roll?
Representative Bethan.
Aye.
Representative Lowe.
She's excused.
Representative Ringo.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Chair Walker.
Aye. Do we have a carrier for this one? I will be there. Walker will carry. Senate Bill 130 is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
But not this one.
Going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 120. Council, would you please give us a summary?
Actually, Madam Chair, I think what I'll do is go over what information you should have. You should have an SMS. You should have a fiscal statement on this bill. And I think I'll just defer to the testimony.
Okay. Jonathan Levy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jonathan Levy. I'm a lawyer in Portland whose practice focuses on estate planning and trusts. And I'm also a member of the estate planning section, executive committee of the estate planning section of the bar that worked on this bill. I'd like to briefly give you the background, the problem that this is designed to deal with, and why we think it will help improve Oregon's law. The revocable trusts, which are popularly known as living trusts, have become an increasing alternative for Oregon citizens in passing their property on to their heirs. With a living trust, instead of having a traditional probate with court review, assets are transferred during your lifetime to your trust, and then they go to your children, to your spouse, and so on. The issue that has come up for many of our clients and many citizens is that, unlike probate, there's no clearly accepted procedure to give notice to creditors to speak or hold their peace when you have a living trust as opposed to a regular probate. And so for many families, they're presented with a dilemma. They'd like to use living trusts, but they fear that if they don't go through the court mechanism, that creditor claims can be presented perhaps years after the person who passed away, the date of death. And if they go through the court probate process, that will avoid the benefit that many of them are seeking to gain by not going through all the paperwork of probate. The proposed solution would simply track existing probate, in that families would have a choice. They could give notice to the world, and then creditors could speak or hold their peace essentially within 4 months, or if they choose not to, they could not give notice, and then as it simply take the chances that the assets will be vulnerable to creditors' claims. This is the people who worked on drafting this represent both sides of the table, creditors and families with trusts. and we tried to create a proposal that would be fair to both sides. I've submitted written technical comments about the bill, which I ask to be included in the record, and I urge support for this bill. Thanks.
Any questions of Mr. Levy?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just a clarification in Section 2, the beginning of that, it says not later than 4 months after the death of the grantor, the trustee may give notice to persons with claims. Does that mean that publication can't be utilized after 4 months from the death of the grantor?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, I confess that when I reviewed the text of that this morning, I wasn't sure why the 4 month rule was in there.
Because we don't have to initiate probate within 4 months, and I'm wondering if we are trying to tie this in. I was just curious, why that 4 months?
I suspect that's a typographic error. The basic idea is that after notice is given, that creditors have 4 months to speak or hold the peace. And so I'm embarrassed I didn't catch this earlier, but I'm not sure.
Is that on line 19?
Yeah, it's lines 18 and 19 there. I think we'll probably need to clean that up because I don't think there's any purpose to be served in creating a four-month window within which publication has to be made. It's really more, you're right, it's the 4 months the creditors would have to respond after publication that's more critical. And Madam Chair, if I can follow up?
Yes.
As long as we're looking at it, the other thing, on line 4, I'm sorry, page 4, Section 9, this is allowance and disallowance of claims, and this looks to be pretty much patterned after what we have in the probate code. And beginning in subsection 4, there it talks about what happens if a trustee disallows a claim. And then on line 27, we have the language, if a claim is disallowed, the creditor may file a request for summary determination. I'm wondering, that works in probate where you've already got a case, a proceeding, but where you're dealing, I assume, in this trust, you don't have a court proceeding that's instituted yet. This would be the first instance, probably. And so I'm wondering what that summary determination is in this context outside of probate and how that would be different from commencing a separate action, which is on line 29. And whether that might need to be cleaned up in redrafting, too, unless I'm missing something.
Madam Chair and Representative Shetterly, the idea is that there would be a new proceeding, that the a proceeding would have to be filed in probate court, but that doesn't represent a significant change from existing procedure in the sense that the probate court now has jurisdiction to resolve questions and disputes involving trusts. So the parties would simply go over to probate court to have the claim determined as they would for other trust matters, and I don't see that as a drafting problem.
Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Well, I guess then what's the difference between 4A and 4B? Because, again, we don't have a court proceeding ongoing at this point in time. Nothing's been filed yet. The first instance is going to be the creditor's claim, that's the disallowed claim that's filed by the creditor with the court. And I'm not sure what the difference in this context is between a summary determination and commencement of a separate action against the trustee on the claim.
A summary determination is a ruling by the probate court that's not appealable. It's the same as in traditional probate. The parties can make a choice. They can get quick and rough justice, no chance of appeal, but it's over. Or they can go to a regular court proceeding where if somebody's dissatisfied, they can appeal it up to the Court of Appeals. So this really is parallel to probate in that sense, that there's a two-track process, either summary determination where the probate judge decides and that's the end of the matter, or a regular hearing where either party reserves the right to appeal.
Okay. Another question. Thank you very much.
May I ask a question of the committee, please?
Sure.
I'm wondering how the procedure would be in terms of fixing that glitch. That
we have two options. We can pass it out of the subcommittee with the change that you've discussed, and then I would take it off of the full committee this afternoon and put it on either Wednesday or Friday's full meeting, and in the meantime request the amendments from Legislative Council. Or, and this is the chair's discretion, we cannot do a work session today, get the amendment, and then go through the subcommittee, and then to the full. It's up to the chair, actually. So we don't have two options. The chair has two options.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think, do we have anyone else that wanted to testify on this? Okay. Thank you very much. And what the chair is going to do, being that our schedule is somewhat busy for the afternoon sessions, I would prefer that we get the amendments and then pass it through our subcommittee before we go to the full committee when we have new amendments coming in. So in this situation, that is what we will do if council would take care of the requested amendments here on Senate Bill 120. That is what we will do.
And then I think that given how busy I believe Elsie is, that I'll put it back on Monday for a work session.
That would be fine.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterling.
Could I ask Brad Swank a couple questions?
Certainly. Mr. Swank, would you come forward, please?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel with the State Court Administrator's Office. Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, how can I help you?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that we are clear on what the courts understand about this request for summary determination. I understand the distinction procedurally and how they work. Now, of course, in probate, you've already got the probate going on when you file this request for summary determination. There's no filing fee associated with that. That's just part of the court case that's already going. If a court administrator were to receive a request for summary determination that there's no case going on now. This is a trust that's not being probated, and so you have a creditor filing a request. I guess it would be a document entitled Request for Summary Determination, creditor versus so-and-so, the trustee of this trust. Would the courts treat that as a complaint in the first instance
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, I actually haven't looked at the bill you're talking about personally. Normally what happens when trial court administrators get something that they don't recognize, they treat it as a new filing.
Yeah.
And people, unless the bill has treated it differently or specified, what happens is you get charged the filing fees and they post it and the notices go out and whatever procedure has been established in the bill, but I haven't specifically read. I mean, that's what would happen. They'd post it on OGIN and notices would be sent out as required by the bill, and it would be treated like a new filing normally. As I say, I haven't read the bill, so I don't know if it has any specific procedures in it. Does that help?
No, it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what I'm going to have Ms. Chartel do is to work on the amendment as requested on page 1, lines 18, 19, regarding the 4 months. And if you might get some clarification as well on page 4, section 9, subsection 4, A and B. Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 120. Senate Bill 124. I'm going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 124. Do you wish to give us a summary or shall we?
It's just as easy, I think,
okay.
For him to come. Carl Myers.
Carl Myers, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. This bill is sponsored by the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Unfortunately, a member certified expert from the Family Law Section could not be here, so you get my lack of expertise in that stead. Senate Bill 124 simply allows that in cases where there is a stipulated judgment, that those can be entered into the file without the necessity of a hearing in a divorce case. Under current law, a divorce judgment can be taken by affidavit, that is, in lieu of a hearing, in certain cases, but that does not include cases in which there is a stipulated judgment. It would seem to me to streamline the judicial process if the parties have agreed, they've entered into a stipulated judgment, that they would not have to appear for a hearing, they could just do it by affidavit. There is a section in the statute that requires, that sets forth what are the requirements in that affidavit. This is just to add those cases in which there have been, the parties all agree that attorneys have signed off, they've stipulated into a judgment to submit that by affidavit without having to come in for a hearing. Judicial economy and cost savings to the parties.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Myers? Okay.
Thank you
very much. I don't think this is one that we have any issues on here. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 124 and open the work session on Senate Bill 124.
Madam Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Move Senate Bill 124 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 124 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please, Ann.
Aye.
Representative Burrow.
Excuse.
Representative Ringo.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Do I have a carrier for this one? Okay, Representative Backlund will carry this to the full committee for us. And Senate Bill 124 will pass to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Just to let the committee members know, we just received the amendments to 3912.
Ann, could you hold those up, please?
That's one copy of the amendments. So we're going to get those photocopied this morning, and that and the handout that the proponents provided to us, I'll have delivered to you this morning. That'll give you a little bit of time between now and Wednesday to read that at your leisure.
Thank you. At our leisure, I like that. Okay. Senate Bill 429. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 429.
Is there anyone here on that bill?
Is there anyone here to testify on 429?
Okay.
Council, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think if you've had an opportunity to read the staff measure summary on this, it does a pretty good job of summarizing what the bill does. This bill was sponsored by the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And if you're not familiar with what that board does, it supervises people who have been determined to be been found guilty, but for the reason of a mental illness. And so they're supervised by the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And one of the programs that the review board has is conditional release, which says that these people aren't a danger to the community and they can be supervised in the community. Sometimes that doesn't work, and as you see in the second paragraph of the background, it explains that people that are responsible for supervising the person, including a community mental health program director, treatment facility, a peace officer, or another person, may order that the individual be taken back into custody. At that time, they need to be transported to the state hospital. Under current law, it says that they must immediately be transported to the state hospital. And according to information from the Senate hearings, the PSRB reports that rural and smaller law enforcement agencies periodically are not able to immediately transport a person in this circumstances due to having a smaller number of staff and or having to travel greater distances. So Senate Bill 429 makes the change of deleting the word immediately from line 34 of page 2 and makes the change as soon as practicable. It does not specify a specific number of hours or days in which the individual must be transported to the state hospital, but rather says as soon as practicable. Of course, the current law doesn't specify a specific number of hours or days either. It just says immediately. So I think this is just giving probably, and this is just my opinion as opposed to based on any testimony that I'm aware of, I think it's just probably codifying what actually happens, which is as soon as the local law enforcement agency is able to, they transport the person to the state hospital.
Senate Bill 429. Okay. Any particular? There's no one here.
No, there's people here.
Well, they're important people here, but not on this bill.
Yeah, it does. I would just like to comment that being from a rural area, I know that one of the problems that we have in transporting people is that if they come in or are in there on a weekend and you can't get someone to transport until Monday, by the time you call, arrange for the vehicle and that kind of thing. So I think this is a very practical solution. So, okay, I am going to close the hearing on Bill 429, open the work session on Bill 429.
Chair.
Representative Ringo.
I move that we pass Senate Bill 429 to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Ringo moves Senate Bill 429 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Being none, would you call the roll, please, Ann?
Representative Bachman?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Brinkle?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 429 moves to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier? Representative Ringo? Thank you. Open the work session on House Bill 2335.
Mm-hmm.
Council?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
2335.
Okay.
An update on that one.
Thank you.
Sorry?
That's okay. I'm listening to them bicker. Okay.
Discussing.
Discussion.
House Bill 2335, we had a public hearing on this. As you'll recall, it is the Judicial Department's housekeeping bill. They had some amendments they wanted to talk about, and I think they're still in that situation, but I guess we should hear from Brad Swank to tell us what's going on with the Dash 1 amendments.
There's also Rose Jade here. You want to come forward also? Is there anyone else that wanted to make comments on these amendments?
Chair Walker's member of this committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel of the State Court Administrator's Office. When I last testified in my original testimony, you'll note that we wanted to add two amendments to our housekeeping bill. The amendments, and they weren't done by counsel's office last time, so we asked for it to be set over. The amendments came out. We got a draft copy Thursday afternoon so we could get something to the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The final, I believe, didn't come out until sometime late Friday afternoon. First thing Friday morning, we got copies to the OCDLA, Ms. Swenson, who you know, and Mr. Hauser, who you probably also met, and said, you know, ask for a heartburn read on that. How big of a problem is this? We didn't hear anything by the end of the day Friday. I talked to Ms. Swenson about 5:30 Friday afternoon, which was too late to pull it off your calendar, and we exchanged emails over the weekend. She asked if the OCDLA could have a couple of more days to look at this. We're not trying to sandbag anybody with this amendment. We ask, you know, we're interested in the bill. We're interested in the amendments. We don't want to slow it down, particularly on the other hand. if there are issues concerned with the amendments that we're proposing, we think they should be fairly presented to the committee, so if there are any policy decisions you could make. So we don't have any problem with it being set over. The amendment that is in discussion that I think is they're concerned about primarily is the one to respond to the Brownhill decision. It would establish procedures in statute for defense attorneys to obtain confidential jury records so they could challenge whether or not the statutes were followed on putting together a jury pool. And as I say, those are things that we'll be willing to talk to the OCDLA between now and when this bill is set over so the issues can be fairly presented to you if that's your desire. And I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Swank? Thank you, Mr. Swank, very much. Appreciate it. Look forward to getting those. Hey, Ms. Jade, you've given us a packet of information here. If you would please like to summarize that for us, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. Basically, I'm probably the reason that this amendment is being offered to you. I'm an attorney, and approximately 3 years ago, I was a third chair in a capital case down in Medford, and I went down to the jury clerk and asked for a copy of the jury list and was told that Salem had decided that these jury lists were not public records and I couldn't have one, even though my client was facing the death penalty. I have not stopped fighting this issue, and either has the state court administrator. The issue of whether the jury lists are in fact public records is currently before the Oregon Supreme Court on an emergency appeal with the state court administrator's office as a named party. So I find this very interesting that they're in here today while this very issue is pending before the Oregon Supreme Court. I've included in this package Judge Redding's opinion out of Multnomah County finding that the jury lists are public records. From my perspective, and I'm the only qualified expert on jury pool composition in the state that I know of, I've testified in approximately six counties, mostly in capital cases, seeking access to these lists for the last 3 years. Judge Redding reviewed the 1985 legislative session, and I have a transcript of that session that's been introduced into various courtrooms across the state, where this legislature basically found that these are public records. Historically, they have been public records since Oregon was formed. And it's very interesting to me that the state court administrator is in here attempting to exempt jury lists from the public records law, because that's basically what this amendment would do. There is no protection in this amendment for non-litigants. A person who's a prospective juror, like myself, in Lincoln County. I went down recently to the courthouse in Lincoln County and asked to see my jury source list and my jury master list. I can't get it. For some reason, it's a secret. Now, I can go get my voter registration list. I can go get my DMV list. You go down to those state agencies, you pay a fee, they turn over the disk or the printed out list, however you want it, and that's the end of the story. The jury lists in this state are compiled from public records. They're compiled from the DMV list and the election list. There is no expectation of privacy on behalf of anyone on either of those lists, and historically, jury lists have to be public records. They are the list from which jurors are drawn to serve in criminal and civil cases. I think the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association should be notified of this amendment. I think the Oregon State Bar should come in and weigh in on this amendment. Most importantly, in the past 3 to 5 years, there's been various bills proposed to change the qualification factors for jury service. For instance, we now exclude felons. We had a short-lived bill that made it a requirement to be a registered voter for criminal trials. And every time those kinds of bills are introduced, you ask the person who's proposing it, what kind of effect will this legislation have on the cross-section of the community that, you know, from which the jury pools are drawn? No one can answer that question because nobody does the statistical studies. Under this proposed amendment, a scholar at the University of Portland, for instance, or myself or any other interested party would not be able to get the list to do those kinds of studies, to come to you with that kind of information.
I do not understand why the state court administrator wants to make these lists secret. All I know is they put together the list. There's no statutory authority for them to do so, except now in this proposed amendment, but whatever. They take it upon themselves to put together these lists, and they want to put a cloak of secrecy over their own work product. I find this extremely disturbing.
Chair Walker, if I might.
Mr. Swain, let her finish her testimony.
In my submitted testimony, I would just like to say that this issue of whether the jury lists currently are public records or not has been argued, and it's now pending in front of the Oregon Supreme Court. Litigants have raised the issue of whether privatizing these lists will violate Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution, which is no secret courts, and the public administration of justice. I believe making these lists secret would. And they've also challenged it under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, because these are public documents. Jury records historically in Oregon have been on the court register. You've been able to go down, see if you've been included, if you haven't been included, what the problem is. And I'll let you peruse this. I would like to say that I have the full transcript of the 1985 legislative hearings. I didn't include that in here, but I do have it. Judge Redding's opinion, and there's a graphic here, a pyramid graphic that talks about the different kinds of lists, and also a summary of the last 10 years of the mistakes the state court administrator has made in putting together these lists. And I just urge you to continue to let the sun shine in on these jury lists, because it's only with public access and critical evaluation that they can get better. Allowing the state court administrator to privatize these lists will violate the Oregon and the federal constitutions. And I appreciate your time in letting me speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Chang. Mr. Swank.
Chair Walker, if I might, I guess I'm a little taken aback by sort of the attack on our integrity on this one. As Ms. Jade knows, the state court administrator has been operating up for some years under an extant attorney general's opinion, which declared these records to be exempt from public disclosure based on statutory interpretation. And we have been following that, as we believe it is our duty to do, once there's an outstanding attorney general's opinion interpreting the law. This is a matter that, in fact, has been before the Supreme Court on statutory interpretation, as Ms. Jade suggests that the OCDLA should be informed of this and given an opportunity. That's exactly why we're here today. We gave them the amendments as soon as we had them, asked them to comment. We're here this morning to ask for an extension so they can have a longer time to review it. As I said before, we're not trying to sandbag anybody on this. Ms. Jade knows that the law is not clear, that it was described as an ambiguity, and that there was an attorney general's opinion, which she failed to mention when she said she didn't understand why we were withholding disclosure of the jury records over the years. We're more than willing to come and discuss this for you. We believe that the representatives of the OCDLA who are signed up should have the chance that they want to review this issue and to look at the amendments, and as I say, that's why we're here this morning. But I think you should know that there was an attorney general's opinion that we were operating on that has been around for quite some time, interpreting this language, and it was not just on some kind of fiat that we weren't disclosing these lists to Ms. Jade.
Thank you. Is there any question of yes, Representative Ringel?
Thank you, Brad. I understand that in implementing that attorney general's opinion, I guess my question is, do you have an opinion as to whether the lists ought to be private or not? That's not really part of your calculation, is
it? Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, that's really not our issue. Our issue is what the legislature has declared, and that's what we've been following. One of the things that was noted in the Brownhill decision was that there was no procedure. For it, you know, the Supreme Court felt that this was information that under a broad interpretation of many statutes people should have, and there was no procedure for them to get this. So we brought forth amendments to establish a procedure so people like Ms. Jade, who's a litigant, can get the information that she wants to challenge the procedure, because the Supreme Court specifically noted that ultimately the question of whether or not jury lists are public record or partially disclosable or usable just for challenges is a decision that's up to the legislature, and we're trying to follow the legislative intent as we understand it. But that's your decision ultimately, and there are policy ramifications, but you should know that for some years they have not been disclosed, because that was the interpretation, not just ours, but the Attorney General's interpretation of the existing statute.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Jade, can you please tell me how these lists might be abused?
Representative Lowe, no, because I don't think they can be. That's what's so disturbing about this whole thing. I don't believe there's any commercial value to the list. The list is currently compiled from otherwise public records. The problem is, and just to make note, I've included that Attorney General opinion and Judge Redding's analysis of it, where he found the legislative intent was not consistent with the Attorney General's opinion. But to answer your question, the problem for litigants, many times when I testify in court, the judge will ask, why don't you just go by the DMV list, and why don't you just go by the voter reg list and put it together and do this? Why do you have to get this exact list from the state court administrator? And the problem is when they merge the DMV and the voter election list, they merge it with their own software, and they try and delete the duplicates. For instance, I should be on that list twice because I'm registered to vote and I'm a driver. So they run it through their software. But more importantly, DMV and the elections office, on the day they ship their list to the state court administrator, that's a snapshot list. After that day, they destroy that list. I can't go down and get the exact list that the state court administrator got from the DMV or the elections office. I can only get it from the state court administrator. If I'm an attorney in court and I want to talk about the jury pool, I need to talk about the exact list from which my jury was pulled. I can't go down and go make up a list 6 months later and bring that into court and expect a judge to care about my list that I compiled. They want to see the list that the state court administrator filed. I probably read 400 cases from across the country on jury pool challenges. You have to use the data that the court used to compile the list. Right now, because there's no preservation requirement for the elections office or for DMV, the only person who has the exact list, the foundational base source list, from which my jury pool is pulled, is the state court administrator. Furthermore, you know, just in terms of the fiscal impact and the public policy issue, this issue, which I started litigating 3 years ago, we've stalled out approximately a half dozen death penalty cases for over 3 years now because the state court administrator won't give us our jury list. And when you look at the impact that it's having on criminal cases, why they would want to set up a scheme where they're going to become a party to every time somebody needs to see the jury list, I don't understand. I would think that they would have better things to do with their budget than budget time and attorneys to fight this in court every time it comes through. I just do not understand it. It would be so much easier if they behaved like the elections office and the DMV office, where they said, you want a copy of our list? Give us $800. Here it is. Go away. There's plenty of protection for prospective jurors, you know, for tainting jury pools and disclosure requirements already in the law. They don't need this amendment. And the only other issue that I'd like to speak to on the first part, Section 13, is I think the legislature really needs to decide whether jurors are going to be covered by workers' comp. I mean, if we're paying them and we're talking about hourly wage, I think it's very important that you make it clear on the record whether jurors are going to be covered by workers' comp. We're currently litigating the issue of forcing jurors to work inside the state prisons, where theoretically you waive your liability if you're inside a prison, and the issue of who's going to cover these jurors if something happens to them in the prisons is an important issue. Are they covered by workers' comp or not? If you're going to take up this amendment, I think that issue should be addressed head on. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. We will await the amendment, and then we will reschedule.
Thank you.
Actually, we have the amendment.
We do have it?
Yes.
It's there.
Yes. Dash one amendment.
Dash one.
Oh, here it is.
Okay.
Walker, if I might, we were asking for the OCDLA to have time to go through it so we could see if they had issues we could talk.
I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you. And we will reschedule then.
Thank you,
Ms. Jade. Thank you, Mr. Swank.
Thank you, Committee.
We will continue this work session at a later time. Open work session on House Bill 2949.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2949 says that it's sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. In fact, what it is a proposed bill to clarify that may not and shall not are considered equivalent expressions of absolute prohibition. We had a public hearing on this a few weeks ago, I guess back in the end of March. At that time, we had Legislative Counsel Greg Chamoff explain sort of the trend or the approach that Legislative Counsel has taken, which I believe was that may not is the accurate wording to be used for absolute prohibition. And I think there was some consternation on the committee because many people felt that shall not seemed more absolute. And the bottom line is that I think that Legislative Council, when they draft, they have a preference for may not, and I think they also, in fact, send out materials to all legislators at the beginning of the session or in training or whatever that they provide saying that they prefer may not. But there's a sense by many that shall not should be the expression of absolute prohibition. Lots of confusion, and I spoke to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court about this, and he said that he too saw some confusion and that he felt that it was important for the legislature to clarify what the legislature means when they draft. And so he felt that a bill such as this that says that may not and shall not are equivalent could help alleviate some ambiguity when the courts interpret statutes.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative Ringo.
We're in work session on this,
yes,
right?
Yes, we are in work session.
Okay. I move House Bill 2949 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Ringo moves House Bill 2949 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I hesitate, but I think this is...
Those of us that who have homework as children may not shall not. But if it will make the justice's job a little bit easier, I think that perhaps that's what we need to do.
Well, I guess the very fact that there is disagreement and the fact that Legislative Council is drafting may not and other people feel that shall not is more absolute, that shows you the purpose of the bill.
I think so. Roll call, please, Ann.
Representative
Dawson?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Excused.
Chair
Wilson? Aye. House Bill 2949 passes to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. May I have a carrier for this may not, shall not bill?
Oh, come on, let me do it.
Representative Lowe will carry it to the full committee. Thank you.
Oh, I hope I get to carry it to the floor.
Oh. That would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be.
Okay, House Bill 3245. I'm going to open the work session on 3245.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3245, involved concerns about, how investigations of alleged abuse, were conducted and whether or not they were, the persons doing those, investigations had adequate training and whether or not, their investigations were impartial. The original bill, had potential for a huge fiscal. It has been amended. We had a work session last time in which there were -2 and -3 amendments. The -2 amendments have been withdrawn. The -3 amendments come to you from the proponents, and my understanding is that the -3s have a no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. I believe, did you wish to comment on these? No? Yes or no? Mr. Junedep.
Madam Chair, Bob Junedep from Oregon Advocacy Center. Just that the -3s are a result of working with the Office of Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services and appear to be acceptable to all parties.
Okay. And you agree that the -2s have been withdrawn?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Junedep?
Are we in work session?
We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendments.
Representative Lowe moves the -3 amendments to House Bill 3245. Any discussion? -3 amendments are adopted. Excuse me, I think I should have said any objection. Hearing none, they are adopted. Okay, Representative Lowe.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3245 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Lowe moves House Bill 3245 as amended.
Yes.
To the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please, Ann.
Representative Bassett?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Bingo?
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3245, as amended, is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier, please? Representative.
Well, next time, you end up with a lot of them.
I know, and it irritates Max, but I don't mind carrying it to the full. He can. He can.
Well, let's just irritate Max. Well, that was.
Yeah, go for it.
The full committee. Okay. House Bill 3245, full committee. And thank you, Mr. Junedep, for coming forward on that. I appreciate it. And we are adjourned. 5 o'clock this afternoon.